Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journey.
But as I started talking to my friends about giving, I realized they didn't trust nonprofits and didn't trust charities. There was a huge disenchantment, and the biggest problem people had was a question around money. Where does my money actually go? All of the data from our water projects around the world, the photos, the GPS proof, the names of the community, and we could be completely transparent about where every single project was.
I'm very pleased today to introduce Scott Harrison. Scott is founder of Charity Water, a non-profit organization based in the US that provides clean and safe drinking water to people in developing nations. Since 2006, Charity Water has raised over $170 million and funded more than 13,000 water projects in 22 countries. It's more than 700,000 donors worldwide. Charity Water has pioneered new standards of transparency on its project work and has developed a funding model where 100% of public donations goes directly to programs on the ground. Thank you very much, Scott, for taking the time to speak to Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs today. It's an honour to speak to you, and I'm looking forward to an opportunity to hear a little bit about your experience and some of the insights and learnings on your journey. A good place maybe to start, if you could tell me a little bit, just kind of an overview of your organization and the scope of your activities today.
Sure. So Charity Water is based here in New York City. We are a nonprofit bringing clean and safe drinking water to people now in about 24 nations around the world. Started 8 years ago on a couch, and I just really wanted to try to reinvent the way people thought about charity, the way that they gave, as well as solve, you know, what we thought was one of the biggest problems in the world, which was the lack of access globally for about 750 million people to clean water. So we've done a bunch of stuff over 8 years, but we've managed to raise about $170 million through the generosity of 700,000 people and fund, a lot of water projects that'll help over 5 million people get clean water in about 13,000 villages.
Wow, that's very exciting. A great result in over that time. It seems that there, it's a huge problem, clearly water, and on various levels, and sanitation and availability of clean water. What would you say is it that makes that's distinctive or different about your organization?
Well, when we started out, I was 30 years old, so I did not have experience running a nonprofit. I didn't come out of the kind of international development scene. I was actually a nightclub promoter for 10 years. So I was a storyteller, I guess you could say. But effectively getting people drunk at very high price points in trendy clubs in New York.
So someone has to do it.
I had a big life change at 28 years old after 10 years in the business, and I had walked away from a Christian faith as a kid, and just basically lived a destructive life of sex, drugs, and rock and roll and gambling, and I picked up every vice that there was to pick up. So at 28, I just radically changed my life. Began to, re-explore faith, re-explore service to the poor, which is something I'd just never done. And I wound up selling all my possessions and living in post-war Liberia. So I took my first trip to the African continent and went into a post-war environment with 14,000 UN peacekeeping troops. And I embedded with a group of humanitarian doctors. And spent about 2 years volunteering for a pretty great group called Mercy Ships that just sailed a giant hospital ship up and down the coast of Africa and brought some of the best, most qualified doctors in the world to meet the needs of people who just didn't have access to quality medical care. So it was there in Liberia that I learned about the water crisis. As I went into the villages, I saw people, kids, men, women, drinking from swamps, drinking from ponds, drinking the most disgusting water that I wouldn't even give my dog, and started learning about the link between the bad water, or the lack of access to clean water and sanitation, and all of the disease that was just so pervasive in the country. So as I, you know, thought about starting an organization, that's kind of how I came into the issue of water at 30 years old. But as I started talking to my friends about giving, I realized they didn't trust nonprofits. They didn't trust charities. There was a huge disenchantment. And the biggest problem people had was a question around money. Where does my money actually go? How much of my money actually reaches the people you're saying I am to help? And I thought this might be solved through just a unique business model. You know, what if we made a promise to the public that we would use 100% of their money without exception to, in our case, directly fund water projects, and somehow went and found another group of people to pay for all of the overhead. Overhead was necessary, but, you know, the public didn't trust charities, so let's not make it their problem. And then the second thing we would do is we would use the available technology to show people what their money did, to tie them and connect them to their impact. The way that we started there was we were very fortunate to start Charity Water at the same time as Google Earth and Google Maps. And Google had given us this free place to put all of the data from our water projects around the world, the photos, the GPS proof, the names of the community, and we could be completely transparent about where every single project was. And we said, we'll never fund a project unless you can actually go there. So you could get a GPS unit from our site, and you could go to over 10,000 projects. You know, probably take you 8 years, but we've made that information public. And then kind of the third idea was just trying to build a beautiful brand and to use good design and aspirational positive storytelling to really build this movement. A writer named Nick Kristoff had written in the New York Times that people were out there peddling toothpaste with more sophistication than all the world's life-saving causes. And I just thought that was so true, and it was so sad, and it was so broken. Where was the Apple of the charitable space? Where were the Nikes? Where were these kind of aspirational brands? You had big charities, but there was nothing like that in the space. And so that was really what we were trying to do different, create a compelling business model where 100% of the money went, people could see where their money went, and we built a beautiful brand, and then use that empowered community, that generous community, to tackle one of the biggest issues facing the poor, which was lack of access to clean water and sanitation.
Well, that's very interesting, the different pillars there and the different ways in which you're differentiating what you do, I guess, based on your, you know, observations about what wasn't working, or, you know, some of the challenges, I guess, traditional charities faced. I mean,
yeah.
do you...
And I'll say that, you know, it really worked. So the first 5 years of the organization's growth, we were averaging 90% year-over-year growth. Over that time, the compound giving in across the sector was net negative. So, you know, we were looking at, you know, 400 or 500% growth versus actually a shrinking sector. So, you know, we saw some of those new ideas, you know, really play out in just dollar donations and in the quick growth of the organization.
You talked about the transparency and the importance of transparency. And I guess that came out of an insight about maybe a lack of trust or certain questions that people have about charities and where the money is going. What else has been, would you say, integral and key to your success in raising such a substantial sum of money over the last 8 years?
I think we have built a culture of storytelling. People respond to stories. You know, we think in stories, and we're also very visual communicators. You know, it's one thing for me to tell you about, you know, hey, a kid in Ethiopia drinking dirty water, and it's another for me to show you that child, or even make a video about her life when she gets up in the morning, when she puts the pot on her back, when she walks 6 hours in the hot sun to finally arrive at a source that might make you think if that was your child, if that was your brother or sister. So I think the organization has just always had a language of visual storytelling, visual communication. And it's not expensive. I mean, you know, that's the beauty. We've made 400 or 500 videos now, and, you know, it's just something a bunch of us know how to do. We just had a team member shoot and edit an entire video on his iPhone. so, you know, the cost has come down of so many of these things. So I'd say that's one of the big keys. I think, you know, just the model, you know, this 100% model has turned out to be very powerful for us. It's also very, very difficult and very challenging. So kind of a warning here. I typically tell people, you know, it's one of the craziest things we ever did, and I don't recommend that other organizations adopt it. Not because, you know, I want us to keep a competitive advantage, but because it's really hard. All of the money that we raise publicly, we can't touch. We can't make payroll with. We can't pay for the office. And we've had to go and fight and tell a different story and find visionary donors who actually want to pay for overhead and now support the 70 staff to make Cherry Water happen every day full-time here in New York. So it is really difficult. It has been key to our success. It's been key to the problem we were trying to solve. But it's not something I go out there and preach, because, you know, it's very difficult. You have to effectively start two organizations with slightly different stories at the same time from zero, and then you have to run them in perfect balance. It's been incredibly challenging, and we've, you know, we've always managed to make it work, but, you know, not something that's for everyone.
Right, right. Can you tell me a little bit about the fundraising that to cover overhead? What is your funding group there? Is this the project which is called The Well? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you a story. We almost ran out of money about a year and a half in. So we'd raised a couple $1 million for water projects. You know, the people were responding to this idea of 100% of the money going. But I just hadn't figured out how to really tell that story, that our staff were necessary, that the overhead, you know, was really important. So we were at a point, I think we had about 5 weeks left in the bank to make payroll, and I had very little faith, to be quite honest. And at that moment, what I did know was that I was not going to touch the money that we'd raised for the water project. I mean, we could have just dipped into that water account and, you know, run the business for a long time. But we'd made this promise, and it never once crossed our mind that we would, you know, touch a penny of the money allocated for water projects. So thankfully, at that moment, I met a stranger, actually, from Britain, a guy named Michael Birch, who was an entrepreneur that had founded a social network named Bebo. And I had a two-hour meeting with him. I explained where the organization was in a year and a half. I explained the vision and just this difficulty in finding people to care about the overhead side. But yet at the same time, the mass public was really responding. We were seeing their trust being restored. So he left the meeting, and I didn't think he even liked me at the time. I didn't think the meeting went particularly well. But he left the meeting, and he wired $1 million into the bank account that needed it. And we went from a few weeks of funding to over a year. With that runway, we began to build a 3-year giving program called The Well. And I've told Michael, you know, he's become a dear friend and has been with me to many, many countries now. Even more than the money, I think it was just him believing in me, the entrepreneur, with this idea. You know, I believe in you, you just need more time. So what that looks like today, 8 years later, there are now 104 Michaels who are all giving at different levels to support the staff and operations. We have people giving at $60,000 a year all the way up to Michael and his wife, who continue to give at $2 million a year now. So 104 people basically make all of Charity Water possible. They make the 100% model possible, and they've made it possible for 700,000 donors to have given in this pure way where all their money goes to the field.
Wow, that's an amazing, amazing result. It's a tremendous sum of money, and it's obviously served as a foundation for all the other funds and supporters.
I'll say just one other thing about that. You know, those 104 people, it's not like they had to be cajoled into that. They love it. They love supporting the staff, the operations. You know, they meet the people that work at Charity Water. These are some of the most extraordinary people. People who have left Twitter, they've left Google, they've left Zynga, they left Adobe, amazing companies, taken massive pay cuts often, given up equity, given up stock options to come and work in service of those without clean water. So it's really a joy for those 104 people, not, you know, oh, wow, I'm giving to the overhead of the organization. They are investors. They are our visionary kind of guardians of this model. Many of them get their companies involved. Many of them provide advice, strategic advice, put ideas into the organization. So it's a really kind of exciting program.
No, I'm very mindful of the point you make that it's not applicable to everybody and that certain caution is required in terms of thinking about this. But what are a few things, questions that somebody should ask themselves to see whether this kind of approach might work for them, particularly this kind of fundraising, and what are a few things that they should bear in mind in order to make this a success?
I would just say, you know, is the problem that you're trying to solve reinventing the way people interact with charity? Because that was really where we started. Water became our issue. But, you know, at the core problem we were trying to solve was, hey, there are a ton of people out here who could be giving, who could be generous, who could be serving others, but they don't trust. You know, the establishment in their mind has betrayed them. So, you know, I would say if your problem that you're trying to solve is to go and build schools, you know, you may not get to scale by having a 100% model. I would go and just be transparent. I think what I most believe people want is just to be transparent. Donors are open to many different value propositions. If I told your listeners right now that the greatest need of Charity Water was for someone to pay the heating bill so that our employees wouldn't be cold, you know, who were working out of this office, or that we needed a toner for our copier, you know, those are excruciating overhead costs, right? Copiers and toners or the heating bill. But there would be a bunch of your listeners that would run to write that check to meet a need as long as they know where the money is going. So I think my advice to, you know, the people that are starting, whether they're social entrepreneurs, whether they're charity founders, just be transparent. Just tell people where the money is going. If your, you know, overhead is 20%, then just be upfront with people and tell them that you're going to put 80% of their money in programs and 20% to run your organization. I think it's the lack of knowing that has really plagued the sector and tainted it for so many people.
Yes, absolutely. And this question, this transparency, obviously a lot's happened and charities are becoming more transparent and there's various impact assessments and things like that, you know, that going on. What's your sense of what's happening there, and how important, how challenging is it to get that degree of transparency throughout the organization?
Well, we just keep kind of pushing it forward on our end. You know, we have all these water projects out there. We have wells and springs and rainwater harvesting systems. And, you know, we know where they all are, but we took it a level farther last year and we said, you know, we know that your well is working on day one. We've got photo proof of that, but we want to know that it's working a couple years later or 5 years later or 7 years later. And we also don't want to spend the money to go and visit, you know, 10,000 plus water projects every single year. That would just be completely cost prohibitive. So we began to say, well, what if we could solve this problem through technology? And we approached Google.org with a crazy idea. We said, what if we could build a sensor that we could put in our water projects around the world? And every time, you know, the well or the spring is being pumped, it would deliver a message back to us in New York and let us know that the project is working and exactly how much water is flowing. And I think this was just a crazy, we said, oh, by the way, we'll need to figure out how to power it, how to transmit, you know, how to make the battery or the solar panel last a long time. And by the way, we want to make it for about $100 so that it's affordable and we could share this knowledge with the entire water sector and even the governments of these countries. So I think it was a crazy enough idea for Google. They wound up writing us a $5 million check, which was tied for the largest gift they'd ever given a nonprofit. And we spent about 2 years working with 20 different labs to develop this sensor. So we have one now. We're very excited. It works. We're about to go into production with 4,000 to start. And that's kind of just the next level of transparency for us to know in real time not only that our projects were built and that the money was well spent, but that they're continuing to serve the communities over time. So I think it just takes a, it kind of takes a value, you know, and a, you know, there are a lot of reasons why we shouldn't do this. You know, you could make a business case of why transparency would be bad. It's only bad news that we're going to get back from our sensors. In the absence of information, every well works 100% of the time forever until a sensor tells you that no water is flowing. But because of the organization's value, you know, because we really want to do the right thing, you know, we're not there just to send pretty pictures to the donor. We're here to continue impacting the lives of people with clean water, you know, for many years to come. So we're doing that because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the relationship with donors there, and it's something that some interviewees have talked about, and a particular charity that's become a social enterprise, a particular charity that's become a social enterprise talked about this. For them, what was attractive was they felt that they were trying to fit into particular boxes or what the donor was looking for, rather than having the ability to really design programs and deliver value to the people on the ground, what they really needed. And they felt that that was a challenge. People talk about, I suppose, this question of educating the donors and so forth to what the reality is on the ground. I mean, how important is that, and what lessons are there there?
You know, I think we've tried to keep things pretty simple at the top. There is tons of information for donors that want more complexity. You know, we realize that people are busy. So, you know, I feel like a lot of charities kind of will hit a donor with everything. You know, hey, please read this 88-page document about the, you know, sustainability of projects in rural Malawi and communities living on less than a dollar a day. We have those documents. Our team uses them. But, you know, that's kind of not how we first approach a donor. And I think we start with simpler stories, simpler true stories. And then for the donor that wants to get deeper with the organization, you know, we're an open book. We post all of our financials, all of our audit reports, our independent audit reports, you know, are online. So there are hours and hours and hours and hours of content that somebody could explore. But most people don't have the time for it. And most people don't have, you know, frankly, the interest level.
Right, right. But by making the information available rather than, I guess, pushing it in their face, but that they know that they can find it if necessary.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. I forget the exact stat, but I saw it was a New York Times article not too long ago about, I think it was the World Bank's website, and they took a look at all of the PDFs that, you know, were on the World Bank website. And, you know, there's tons of very dense content that's written by some of the smartest people in the world. I think they found that 70% had never been downloaded once. You know, imagine that. You know, imagine having 1 million documents online and 700,000 of them never having even been viewed once. So I think that just kind of speaks to, you know, maybe the old way. people aren't looking to download documents and read through, you know, 100-page reports. They want a story told, and they want to be able to understand it in a way that's respectful of their time.
Right, right. And I know, not to to criticize other organizations or so forth, but generically, are there a couple of things when it comes to communication with stakeholders generally that you think nonprofits could do better?
Yeah, so I'm so glad you asked. I hate the, it's kind of what we call the poverty porn. You know, the banner ads with the kids and the fly on the face and, you know, the TV commercials where the child locks eyes with you in slow motion and then the, you know, the number flashes in the bottom of the screen. You know, we so much of the sector has engaged in guilt-based marketing because it works. I don't think that's how you build a brand. If Nike tried to make you feel guilty about being fat or about being lazy or about not exercising enough, if their entire approach was, you know, buy our running clothes, you lazy bum, and get your butt in shape, no one is going to buy their running clothes. You know, Nike has taken a completely different approach, saying, you know, you've got within you something you don't even know. It's powerful. You can achieve the impossible. You're better than you think you are. you know, get out there and just start. And you'll blow yourself away with your capacity, with your, right? So I think that's kind of the positioning that we've taken. We have our values at Charity Water, and then we have these things called isms. You know you're at Charity Water if you hear this conversation, if you observe this behavior. So one of those isms is it's about opportunity and not guilt. We're not afraid of talking about some of the harsh reality that we're seeing out there, but we want to invite people into the story. We want to give them an opportunity and not try to guilt them in. It should be a joy to give. It should be a joy to use our influence and our affluence in the service of others, whether it's with our time, whether it's with our talent, whether it's with our money. And it should not be, we shouldn't be guilted. We shouldn't have to be guilted or shamed into that. I know some of these charities have been doing it for years. I think it's destroying their brand, and they don't know it. Nobody wants to wear, a T-shirt with a charity that has made them feel horrible for 10 years. There are a lot of people that might wear a T-shirt of a charity that has invited them into a giant problem being solved and is celebrating those wins and celebrating the members of the community that are achieving those successes.
That's a very interesting perspective, and I think there's a lot of truth there in terms of, as you say, the opportunities looking forward. And I'm mindful of the time, and a couple of technical questions, if I might. One or two of the social entrepreneurs I interviewed forwarded a couple of questions, and I just to see what your thoughts are. One of them is the whole question about sanitation, and somebody was asking about that, saying sanitation is really important, wondering why you're not focused, or to what extent you are focused on sanitation.
Yes, yeah, so we are. Sanitation is a part of Charity Water projects. Almost all Charity Water projects have not only sanitation but also hygiene components. Again, I kind of mentioned that's that layer a little deeper. We don't lead with toilets. We don't lead with hand washing. We really lead with the basic need of clean water. But we're very, very familiar with the need for the complete wash. It's called a wash packet, water sanitation and hygiene, to actually transform the lives of communities. I saw some data once that looked at just the disease reduction from three solo indicators, and they found that if you washed your hands only, you could reduce disease by about 45%. Get sanitation only, it was about 35%, and water only was actually the lowest, 25%. However, water gives you the opportunity to go into a community and talk about sanitation and hygiene. So we found that water is the starting place, not sanitation and not hygiene, which is why we have started there with our messaging. I have unbelievable sanitation stories just from my travels to our work around the field. I spent a lot of time in Orissa, India, where our partner there, our local partner, Graham Victus, a 35-year-old organization, has really been using sanitation, water, and hygiene to break down the caste barriers there. And Joe Madias is the leader of this org, and he saw many, many, many years ago his grandfather feed one of the workers from the Dalit class from a hole in the ground. And Joe said to his grandfather, "Grandfather, why on earth would you be feeding someone like a dog?" And his grandfather says, "Well, because they are dogs." And something in him just snapped, and he started this organization. And he will go in and force 100% water inclusion, sanitation inclusion, and hygiene on a village. And because of the caste system, 90% of the villages will immediately reject his offer as different castes say, "Well, we won't share water, or we won't share toilets." So he'll actually walk away, and he'll let them deliberate, and he'll work in the 10%, and enough of the impact of his work has spread that villages would break down and break down after years of discussion, some even a decade of, holding out, drinking dirty water, and not having access to sanitation. So, it's a huge component. I'm extremely passionate about sanitation and the data behind it. It's different in every country. In Bangladesh, we're doing water at schools, and Gates is funding the sanitation. So we've basically found a partner for all of the sanitation costs, or I guess you could say Gates has found a partner in us and the water costs. But every single school, you know, that we're working there, you know, not only has access to clean water, but also latrines for girls and latrines for boys.
Excellent. That's very, very interesting. Thank you. What's your vision then, finally, for the next 5 years or 10 years, or how do you look at your vision? What time frame are you thinking?
Well, I kind of have 200 million numbers going around in my head. There's 100 million people served, and we've really focused on the rural poor. A lot of people are doing work in the urban areas and the peri-urban areas. The problem is getting better. So the lack of the number of people without access to water has been dropping. And what we're seeing is the last mile, the people that are just not getting served by the government, that are so far at the bottom of the list, they're the farmers. They're the women that are walking 5 hours a day. They're the rural farmers. So we've picked kind of 100 million people of that bottom segment, and we've only funded projects for 5 million of them. So we're 5% of that goal. Organizationally, we did about $44 million in this past year, and kind of a big stepping stone to that is $100 million a year. What's important about that is it shows that we have built a different business. It's not an incremental business, and where we're looking for the scale is not to the big companies, it's not to the big foundations, although we've been blessed to partner with many of those. It's really through individuals. And something I'll just touch on, you know, before we end is this birthday program we have. We've had thousands and thousands of people celebrate their birthday by giving it up, donating their birthday to Charity Water. And instead of asking for gifts, instead of throwing themselves a party, they ask for their age in dollars or pounds or euros. So 7-year-olds ask for £7, and 31-year-olds ask for 31 euros in France. And we have a 78-year-old who's fundraising right now with a 78th birthday. We've got 89-year-olds. We've got 6-year-olds. It's just kind of a very simple idea. Our birthdays, as a donation, where our friends and families can support our birthday in the service of those who don't even have clean water. So that's an idea that's been spreading, and it's an idea that we're looking to spread. Everybody has a birthday, right? So, you know, your kind of available market there is in the billions. People have birthdays every single year. And we would mimic the contention that people don't need any more crap. You don't need a tie. You don't need a handbag. You don't need a wallet. You don't need an Amazon gift card. You probably have everything you need. And yet there are, you know, 750 million people without the most basic need met. So if our birthdays can help them have more birthdays, we think it's an idea that can really, really spread. So it's just helping more people. It's getting more people involved in the mission. If anybody was interested in that, we have a simple kind of page where people can actually pledge and join that movement at charitywater.org/birthdays. I think I've done 6 now in a row, and it's a blast.
Wow, it's a great idea. I do some work for an organization called SOFI, which is it's about excellence in fundraising, and they have this conference every year, which is I Wish I Thought of That, which focuses on the best fundraising ideas, and like Movember, and just, you know, from around the world, the great Amnesty ones and so forth, and ideas that are translate very quickly or pass and grow. That definitely sounds like one of those ideas. Very simple, elegant, clear, and you know, and as you say, open to everyone. Yeah, that's very interesting. Excellent. So that's been really interesting, Scott. And thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about the great work that you're doing. I wish you the very best of success over the coming years, and thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.